Disclaimer, views and opinions expressed by participants of the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Hey everybody, welcome to AnCast. Slow news this week, kind of expected for this time of year. So we're just going to go ahead and get straight to the interview, as usual. But before we get to that, I've got a couple of little announcements here. Firstly, I finally finished my Garden of Sinners review. Rather, I finally finished watching the series and then wrote the review in about 2 hours. But that's up on the front page right now. Certainly an interesting experience, and I really can't say enough that I hope that there's eventually a reasonably priced version of that, because it's something I think anime fans should be exposed to. It's different. It's not like anything I've ever seen. And that's in both good and bad ways. But it's unique experience, and we're not getting a lot of those now. So here's hoping that at some point a reasonably priced version of it will come on down the road. Wishful thinking, I think, but we'll see about that. A quick technical note about the interview that's coming up here. We were having some audio quality issues right up at the top. You know how these things go, just some Skype problems. But it's listenable. It's not great for a little while, but then that totally clears up about 15 minutes in. So you have been warned, but you know it's not awful. Anyway. And also next week, joining us on the program will be returning champion Chris Beveridge. You all know him, so listen to that show. All right, onward to segment two.
Strong, fearless.
Not bad.
Just an ordinary kid fulfilling his destiny to save the world. Meet Goku. He's one student who's becoming the master. Dragon Ball Evolution.
Okay, we're back. My guest this week, people know who this guy is, Kyle Hebert. He's the probably best known for you know, the guy behind the English language voice of Gohan in a little show called Dragon Ball Z, and some video game, a guy named Ryu. I can't remember the name of it, but anyway, Kyle, thanks for coming on and being on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Sure thing. Happy to have you on. So, how are things going? I see you all over the internet now, how are things going? You're in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, I've been in Los Angeles since 2005. I moved here in the fall. I've left my full-time job in radio to go into the Wild Wild West, a.k.a. Hollywood, and try and chase my dream of doing voiceover. And it's been absolutely the right move for me. But I say that, you know, conditionally, because when you enter the realm of any type of acting, you can't really stay afloat doing that. Auditions don't pay, and the work is dreadfully inconsistent, despite all the help from fellow industry peers kind of passing the demo reels around and everything. But I have made a lot of progress, and I've been very, very fortunate, and I absolutely love what I do so much to the point that it's absolutely worth every second of financial stress and anxiety and depression whenever that phone's not ringing saying, "Hey, Kyle, we need you for a session." So this is literally, you know, chasing my dream, achieving my goals, and just trying to make it happen, because it's always been something I've wanted since childhood.
So that, I mean, you are obviously a grown man, and I think most people moving out to Los Angeles do it pretty early on in their careers.
Yeah.
You know, it's that I'm a crazy kid who's going to be a waiter and desperately try to get auditions for, you know, my 20s.
Right.
But you're a little further along that. So this, do you feel like you have maybe, I understand age is a thing in Hollywood, but do you feel like you have kind of a clearer head on your shoulders, or a little bit more practical approach to doing what you're doing?
Well, you know, different things in life can throw you curveballs. I became a parent in my mid-20s, and so obviously just picking up and leaving and going across the country wasn't really a viable option, at least for me at the time. So becoming a parent obviously made, I think, would make anyone just have to do a lot of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in the mid-20s, which is, you know, not so bad. Obviously, that's pretty common and everything, but you know, when you're someone who's just like, okay, this is my goal, this is what, like, oh, hey, I'm a dad. Oh, awesome. Okay. Right. All right then. And obviously the most important thing in my life is my daughter. And, you know, I've just kind of tacked her onto the goal saying, you know, it's like, all right, this is what I want to do in life. And I'm going to make sure that both of us, are going to be taken care of. You know, I'm going to chase this dream. I'm going to do what I want in life, and I'm going to encourage her to do what she wants in life. You know, she'll be entering high school later this year. And she thinks it's cool what I do, but, you know, she's not really an anime fan, not really much of a gamer, but she does like and appreciate what I do. And I have, so far, knock on wood, have somehow managed to scrape by every month to pay the ludicrous rent and the cost of living here in California.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I'm in Orange County, so it's it's about the same. It's
not right, much better than here. I kind of had some help from her mother at the time when I was saying, you know what, I really got to get out to L.A. before I turn 40. You know, it just sounded like a good even number. So I got out here, by the time I was like 37, I think, 36. So it was just very, very important to me. You know, not a lot of people are able to take such a huge step and go across the country and leave a sure thing, you know, a steady paycheck, insurance benefits, and say, all right, I'm going into the wild blue yonder, and what's going to happen next? I don't know. It could totally blow up in my face, but you know what? I don't want to live a life full of regret wondering what if. I would rather just give it my all and see what happens.
So give me a little bit of a timeline, because obviously you did Dragon Ball before you moved to L.A. Yeah. So you were in radio before that. When did Dragon Ball come along?
Yeah. I was actually on Radio Disney, which is still alive and well, and ironically just walking distance from my apartment now here in Burbank. But at the time, it was based in Dallas, and I was DJ there full time, doing like radio dramas and being on the air and writing, producing, doing all sorts of stuff. And that's kind of what my acting experience was. I heard about general auditions in the summer of 2000, and so I got my foot in the door at Funimation and got about 5 years worth of experience under my belt there with DBZ, Yu Yu Hakusho, Full Metal Alchemist, different things, and cobbled together a demo, started going on the convention scene, started networking with other LA-based actors, such as the great and legendary, I bow before him forever, Steve Bloom, mm-hmm. who facilitated everything out here, putting things into play, saying, you know, hey, Kyle's really talented from Texas. He's got some big stuff under his belt, and you know, he's really good, deserves a shot. So he paid it forward to me, and I'm forever grateful for him kind of jump-starting something that is so near and dear.
Well, obviously, back in 2005, you couldn't have predicted what was going to happen to the anime industry.
No.
Things have changed quite dramatically since then. Was the choice to move to Los Angeles based in you wanting to work in something other than anime? And had you known what was going to happen, would you have stayed in Texas?
Well, my goal since childhood was actually to do voices for cartoons, like domestic stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan, and my inspiration was Mel Blanc, who did Looney Tunes, Bugs Bunny, all those guys. Right. And growing up, I'm a huge fan of cartoons and anime. And, you know, having grown up and getting to do dubs and really thoroughly enjoying the process, the work, and obviously, you know, appreciate all the fringe benefits of not just, you know, getting paid to have fun, but actually getting to, you know, travel the world, go to conventions, meet fans face to face, get the feedback and say, wow, I'm not only entertaining some people, but, you know, I'm just having a blast. And that's always been a very big deal to me. But no, I never said to myself, I want to move to L.A. to focus on anime. I wanted to expand my horizons. I kind of felt like I had plateaued with Funimation. Nothing against them. They obviously gave me my start. But I felt that there's just way more opportunity in L.A. for the kinds of projects that I personally wanted to delve into, like video games and cartoons. And I'm really intrigued by kind of the blending of that with motion capture. A lot of my peers are doing video games where they're, you know, wearing the motion capture suits, and they're actually doing a live action performance, which is then, of course, animated in the computer and everything. It's just this new hybrid sort of acting, and I really hope I get to do that at some point. I never would have foreseen that, you know, growing up. So I just want to do cartoons. And then I grew up, it's like, anime, this is amazing. I used to watch Speed Racer, and now I'm dubbing a show, Dragon Ball Z, that I was a fan of since, you know, 5 years previous when it started airing in the States in 95, the Ocean dub. And I used to walk around the house imitating the narrator. And then 5 years later, I not only get Gohan, but I get the narrator too. And like, whoa, this is crazy. And just getting to go to conventions and just hearing, you know, all the people just going off about, oh, I grew up listening to your voice and everything. It's like, whoa, okay. Not only do I feel old, but I just feel this sense of, oh, that's cool. That's accomplishment. You know, I made a difference in someone's life, even if it's just, you know, making them smile or making them on the edge of their seat, you know, or have fun playing a game or whatnot. It's just a really, really good feeling.
So you mentioned feeling like you'd kind of peaked at Funimation, not peaked, but plateaued. Is that in terms of range, in terms of what you were being offered? How would you qualify that?
Well, what I mean is that I wasn't getting called in as much. I think they started, you know, expanding their talent pool and just reaching out and getting other people in there. They started, you know, calling in a lot of folks from ADV, which, you know, was flourishing as well at the time. And my phone just wasn't ringing as much. And I said, okay, all right. Well, between that and just kind of my radio job getting a little bit stale, I thought, okay. Well, I don't want to become complacent. It's time to take things to the next level. I kind of take this as an omen. It's like, all right, I really need to do this. I need to at least try.
Right. Yeah. You'll never know if you don't give it a shot.
Yeah. I can't just come out here, give it 6 months and then turn tail and run back home. It's like, no, I really need to, you know, give it years if possible, you know. And I have to thank my parents for being true heroes and in supporting me when, you know, things get tough and everything, because they've always said, you know, whatever your dream is, chase it. We support you all the way. You know, it's like I'm about as far different, polar opposite from what my parents are. You know, they're not in the public eye, they're not in the entertainment business, or never, nobody in the family really is. And I'm just really lucky to have such a great support system in place.
Yeah, well, having supportive parents, I don't think is a common story around where you live and in your business. Yeah. That's rare. So after having done Dragon Ball, and then you moved out to Los Angeles, and then if you moved in 2005, 2 years after that, anime is having it's really struggling. Did you get worried, or had you pretty much decided, all right, if I get anime, great, but I'm not relying on this to pay the bills anymore?
Anime has never been a way to pay the bills, because as most of your listeners probably know, if they've ever attended a voice actor panel at a convention, that it's the low end of the totem pole. Your average pay in L.A., and it's lower in Texas, but in L.A., your average pay is about $64, $65 an hour, two-hour minimum. And it's like, okay, well, that's great. It's like, well, it's not a 40-hour week. This is freelance. This is, you know, they call you in for a two-hour session here and there. And unless your character is really chatty, then they'll book you for a four-hour session. But, okay, all right, that's great. That pays, what, the phone bill? How am I going to pay rent?
Yeah, you know, right.
So,
is that rate – is that union? That's not union, is it?
It's union and non. Non-union stuff tends to – at least match the pay.
Right.
The non-union stuff doesn't necessarily reflect a different pay scale because of money issues. It could just be just paperwork or whatnot. And traditionally, yeah, most anime has gone non. But yeah, and like I said, in Texas, it's a lower pay. You know, I make 50 an hour in Texas.
Nice.
And I don't get a two-hour minimum. They throw me a bone every now and then. I go visit my parents, and, you know, I finished up Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood over the Christmas break. And other than that, let's see. If Teen Gohan shows up in DBZ Kai, then great, there's some hours there. But or maybe another DBZ game, maybe. We get, like, a couple a year. Other than that, yeah. I usually do bit parts on everyone's shows. I show up. It's like, hey, I'm in town. You got something? And the directors will say, all right, all shows have those, you know, man A, cop B, monster C.
Right.
You know, someone has to come plug those in. And utility actor is what we usually refer to as. It's like I come in and kind of plug the holes.
So, okay, so if anime is not keeping you afloat, what is? Now, I know a lot of anime folks have moved into video games, and the pay is better. Way better, because those companies have money. So is that what you're doing? Is that what's keeping you afloat?
Yeah. And it's just a bevy of, again, this is LA, land of opportunity. It's not just one studio. Like, being in Dallas, the only real fun creative outlet for voiceover is Funimation. I mean, there's very little else happening in town game wise, and certainly there's no cartoons going on. So you come out to LA, there's multiple studios doing stuff like Bang Zoom, Studiopolis, New Generation to a degree. And back even 5 years ago, there were other studios as well, Media Concepts and such, all tossing in, and it was almost like an assembly line. But yeah, I could never look and say, all right, anime is going to pay my rent this month, because I don't think it ever has. Yeah. I may have a good week and have a session or two, and then followed by 2 or 3 weeks of nothing, and then land some games. And again, multiple game studios, all based here, or at least the studios are contracted here. Using the LA talent, so I could work on one game for one studio one day and another one the next day, and so on, and that adds up significantly quicker.
Have you ever considered some actors I know have gone into full-time production as well as performance? They're doing mixing, they're doing directing, they're doing script writing. Like Sinner Nicholas, he's got his NYAV Post West out there, and he does all of that stuff. Have you ever considered trying your hand at that and expanding your talent base?
I know a little bit about audio mixing. I don't want to. Pro Tools is honestly quite daunting. I see what the engineers are doing, and sometimes my eyes roll back in my head because there's just so much to absorb. And I can do it at a much more basic level. You get me on Audacity or Adobe Audition, I can do okay. But throw me on Pro Tools, I'm like, what? but as a creative outlet, I think it would be a blast to be a director. And having done this for 10 years, I think I'm about as qualified as any other actor to hop behind the other mic on the other side of the booth and call the shots, sure. But there usually is kind of a hierarchy. It's like, okay, you act, and then you write, and then you direct.
Right.
It's very tedious, of course, doing ADR script writing, adapting to the lip flaps, time coding everything. It's very tedious work. You're lucky if you can crank out a minute of screen time in an hour. And your average episode is what, 24 minutes, 26 minutes, 22 right. minutes, something like that.
Yeah.
If you're adapting a movie, oh God. So, and then your availability to work on other projects is kind of stunted then, because you're spending 8 hours plus Monday through Friday in the booth. Yeah, you get to be a symphony conductor, which is great, and kind of plug, all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together. That's got to be really, really satisfying to orchestrate and call the shots and everything. I know that those coveted director positions are few and far between. I'd love to give it a shot someday, but sometimes I get a little paranoid. I don't want to anger my availability for my agent or other studios. It's like, hey, we got a big game for you. Like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm busy the next 6 weeks.
Obviously, that's a skill set that takes years to build, and you've got to jump through all the hoops. It's not something you can just sort of wander in and say, I think I'm going to direct something now.
Yeah, not so much.
So now, you did Gohan, and now you're the voice of Ryu in Street Fighter, which must be a sweet gig, because it's not like they're ever going to stop making games with Ryu in them.
No, but you had what? Street Fighter 4 came out, what, 2 years ago? Super Street Fighter came out, and then now Marvel vs. Capcom 3. We're probably going to sell like hotcakes. Are the actors flourishing because of it? I wouldn't say so, because, you know, hey, let's play Mythbusters for a moment. Actors don't stand to make residuals from video games or anime. We're paid our session fee. So I'm afraid the money I made from recording these games was spent a long time ago.
Right.
It must have been almost a year when I recorded Marvel vs. Capcom. It's like, oh, it's crazy to have to keep your mouth quiet and sign these non-disclosure agreements. And I can't talk about it. It's like Fight Club.
Right.
And then it comes out. It's like, all right, finally. Ah, yes. It's like, oh, you must be raking in the dough. It's like, no, I'm so not. I'm really not. But yeah, I mean, there's always more opportunity coming down the pike. I think looking back at my resume, my credits on my website, it's like, you know, I think I've worked on more games than shows, and certainly made more money doing so. And that certainly helped, because, again, the cost of living is just crushing out here. Rent is just insane. It's twice what it was for me in Texas. And I'm sure, unless you're in New York, you can say, oh, well, it's worse in New York. It's like, well, I'm glad I'm not in New York, I guess. Nice place to visit, but I don't know if I would want to live there.
It's not that much worse. Having lived in both places, it's not that much. They're both freaking expensive.
Yeah, and Vancouver, I guess. Vancouver is like super, super duper expensive. But those guys, the voice acting talent pool, the Ocean Group and whatnot, I mean, they're pulling down six figures a year. They're definitely not hurting.
Right, but they're not, I mean, when was the last Ocean anime dub? It's been a little while.
No, I don't know. I mean, you got Funimation, you know, bless their souls. They're the house that Dragon Ball built, and, you know, they've licensed all these shows. They're cranking out tons of things, and they're really fine-tuned into fans and really working social media and taking the digital distribution model to the next level and just kind of saying, hey guys, we got to lead the charge. We got to nip piracy in the bud and everything. There's less shows being, you know, produced. There's less shows being finished. And then, you know, they'll do well in Japan, come out over here. But if fans have already watched it fan subbed, their drive to save their money and buy the DVD or buy the official download of the episodes is kind of greatly diminished. And I think a lot of people kind of turn a blind eye to it. It's like, well, I'm a fan. I watch the show. It's like, well, okay, but if there's not money going back into the system, how can it sustain itself? And that's been kind of a sad thing. But at the end of the day, I mean, if anime truly just went away and died, it's not like all the voice actors would have no work at all. I mean, for LA, we were always auditioning for other voices. I mean, anime is such a niche thing. It's such a tiny part of the entire entertainment spectrum. I auditioned for many more other types of projects, commercials, games, cartoons. I mean, that stuff is never going away.
Is there anything in particular about doing anime that you personally just enjoy more than the other stuff? Are the fans, I mean, you mentioned that now they're saying, like, I loved Soul Eater, and they downloaded the whole thing or whatever. You know, that's been a problem for years, but do you get more appreciation from your anime work from the fans?
Yeah, I mean, I guess as time goes on and the prevalence and the popularity of video games, you're starting to see more game-oriented conventions sprout up, and certainly gaming is an aspect to anime conventions. And a lot of the voice actors, the talent pool just spills over. It bleeds together. You know, a lot of us can be heard on games and anime. And so now some of us have crossed over into cartoons. I did a little bit part stuff on the Avengers for Disney XD. And certainly, you know, Steve Bloom with Wolverine and Yuri Lowenthal's crossed over. And you know, I hope to follow in their footsteps, because, we're doing cartoon work's great. You get to play off the other cast members, because everyone records together at the same time. Anime, you're kind of in a bubble because you're by yourself. Actors have to do it individually.
So you go to a lot of conventions, a lot of mid-level stuff, local stuff, you know, like Anime LA, all over the country, really. Looking at your con schedule, you're a very busy traveler. What is that experience like for you? Do you appreciate the fan interaction?
It's always been a big deal to me to be hands-on with the fans. When I first got cast on DBZ, I was interactive on fan forums and Instant Messenger And as soon as social media kicked in, I was definitely jumping on that bandwagon because I saw the great potential to reach out and connect with the fan base in a real live time feed sort of sense that's, you know, never been, you know, achievable before. And a lot of my voice acting peers that weren't really accessible suddenly were. They were kind of interested, and it's just a great time. I think the internet has really, despite its flaws and arguments, you know, against the evils of the internet and this, that, and the other, it's certainly been a real driving force for anyone in the entertainment business. It's caused the restructure of everything. I mean, I've even done virtual panels for conventions via Skype and whatnot. But getting to go to conventions of all different sizes, you go to a big one, it gets a little crowded and everything, but mm-hmm. you get people that, you know, they only get to go to one convention a year and that's it. And, you know, you gotta go to the big ones to see what that's like, you know, the Acon, the Anime Expo or Otakon or whatnot. And then you get to go to these small ones. I've gone, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Arkansas and, go to like a Ma and Pa barbecue pit and just like have a blast or just hang out, you know, at 1 a.m. in the hotel lobby with like three or four cosplayers and sit there and just talk about random stuff. It's just so much fun. It's always been a blast, no matter what convention it is. I'm always the guy out there on my downtime, checking out the programming, hanging with fans, walking through the dealer's hall, walking into the gaming room, you know, picking up a controller, trying my hand at it. I still suck as a gamer, but I've always loved games. It's another great perk to what I do. I it's important that I make a good impression on people because I take my craft very seriously. It means a lot to me, and I want to make sure I do right by the fans, you know, giving a Western interpretation to a show that most of them probably have only absorbed in Japanese with subtitles or sometimes raw in some cases.
Yeah, well, that's really cool. So you're very adamant about staying connected with the fan base and the people who are consuming your performances. I don't think that's very common at all, actually.
I think it's a matter of, some people are just busy. You know, some people are married, they've got children. I mean, I've got a daughter, but you know, she's pretty self-sufficient, you know, as a teenager, and I'm a single dad. For me, it's a choice. It's something that I want to do. I want to be available out there. And I've got friends that are kind of advocates for it. It's like, you gotta watch what you put out there. Your private life is suddenly too public and this, that, and the other. It's like, well, I know what I'm doing. And I put out there what I want to put out there. And I use my Twitter feed and Facebook feed to, sometimes, yeah, I'm as guilty as anyone else of putting a negative status update. It's like, oh, God, another depressing emo update about, oh, life sucks and no one will hire me, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's important to paint a realistic portrait to people who want to get into what I do. I talk to so many fans, like, I want to be a voice actor. It's like, it's not glorious. Trust me, you are going to sweat. And if I had hair left, I would have pulled it out by now.
Yeah, it's not a glamorous life.
No, it's not.
With a notable exception, though. I mean, you get to travel internationally to go to conventions.
Yes.
That's really a cool thing. That's a cool perk.
Yeah, it is a great thing. I mean, I know that voice actors do get to enjoy a fair bit of anonymity unless they go to the con and the fans happen to recognize you walking around because they saw your headshot in the program guide or whatnot. Or maybe they watched your panel on YouTube. But outside of that, it's not like I walk down the street and TMZ, you know, paparazzi are chasing me or anything. I think that would just get too surreal. And anytime I go past those entertainment shows, I just go, oh, thank God that doesn't happen to voice actors.
Well, unless you're Vic Mignogna.
Well, okay, there is that. But I think his fan base is like, yeah, he can't even control it. It's such a behemoth at this point.
Yeah. the whole, like, I want to be a voice actor thing, it's like 98% of the questions any fan asks.
Sure.
At any convention panel, everybody in the room is basically there to say, how can I take work away from you? That always kind of makes me chuckle a little bit. But you're actually doing a little bit of fan outreach. You're conducting sort of coaching sessions over Skype with fans. Now, I've interviewed Eric Sherman about his whole, you know, adventures in voice acting thing, controversial as that may be. What's your technique like? What are you hoping to achieve, I guess, with these?
Well, it's very important that I put myself out there to the fans understand that I'm not a quick end to the industry, that I'm not going to turn people into voice actors. Mm. I don't teach voice acting. I can't sit here and get into the acting theory and get into the nitty gritty of this, that, and the other. I don't feel like that's my purpose. I can't articulate things like that because I haven't, I came from radio. And I had a fair bit of luck just crossing over into this. But, you know, most actors who do this profession came from the stage or on camera or whatnot and took acting workshops. I've taken many classes since I became a professional. Mm-hmm. And I've benefited greatly. So the only coach part I would call myself is more of a motivational coach. I want to illustrate to people who take my sessions on Skype that, you know, to become a voice actor, to become a better actor means training. Just like if you want to be a doctor, you go to med school. You can't just say, oh, I met Kyle Hebert and suddenly I have an in. It's like, it doesn't work like that. I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years. I've never been more broke. I get to audition. I have an agent. I'm networked with a great community of actors, and I encourage people to do that. But I want to give them a reality check that say, okay, is it as easy as you guys make it look? What is it like? What are the expectations placed upon an actor in the booth when you're trying out, when you're doing a commercial read, or if you're looking over a character? It's like, how good are your cold reading skills? How good are your listening skills? These things come into play. How good are your improv skills?
Mm.
You know, all actors, even with anime, when we got a rigid sort of dialogue that's written to the lip sync and everything, you're still called upon to improvise, you know, subtle vocal intonations to help sell the emotional beat, to make it sound natural. So I'm appealing to, you know, people who are curious about what voice acting is like and to those who want to get into it. And I always encourage people who take my sessions to really, you know, if they like, you know, dipping their foot into the pool, as it were, that if you want to do this professionally, you got to train. It doesn't come fast, cheap, or easy. You got to take workshops. You got to network, use social media, save your money, and invest in your craft. It is very expensive to make demos, and you don't just jump into it blindly because you happen to know how to record on GarageBand or whatever and throw something together with some sound effects and music. Having a slick demo is not what it's about. It has to be your signature about how you have to sell you as a product. Mm. What sort of can you impress the director or the casting person with who you are, not your Vegeta impression? You know, it's just not going to get you anywhere. So that's my real goal with what I do. I call it like a VO workout or a voiceover critique or whatnot. I don't really say I'm a voiceover coach per se. There's so many other people that wear that crown, rightfully so, people that I've studied with and have been doing it for 20, 30 years and continue to ring out people who are better because they took the classes and they're more forearmed and can make a really awesome demo and take things to the next level.
Do you see a lot of natural talent out there?
Sure. Absolutely. The internet has made it possible for, you know, people in all walks of life to cross over. I mean, dare I say it, but, you know, Justin Bieber got discovered on YouTube. Anything is possible. Love him, hate him, roll your eyes at him. Just think about that. That homeless guy, I forgot his name, but
the golden voice dude. Yeah. You know, he was homeless, you know, and then suddenly he was a big, huge celebrity, and he comes out here and he gets this wonderful opportunity. You know, he had all these great big voice actors pool their money together and pay his union dues. And now he's in rehab. I mean, unfortunately, it sounds like he's relapsed into his drug problems again, which is really sad. But yeah, it was a very inspirational story, though.
Right. For a little bit.
For a little bit. And then reality set back in. It's like, right. Well, not even I guess his name was Ted Williams. I don't think, you know, he came from a blossoming career. And then it dovetailed into the, you know, trenches with, you know, his drug addiction and whatnot.
Right. Well, yeah. Plus, you put someone like that in an environment where they're successful in show business and out of control right away.
Absolutely. It just spirals. It is crazy. You know, I guess it's good practice being a struggling actor because it helps, you know, build backbone and character and having a thick skin. And you'll have a deeper appreciation when you do get those phone calls and the paychecks come in and everything. It's like, okay, this pays off. You don't get too complacent and too spoiled, as it were, by success.
Right, but it's nice to be spoiled sometimes, I think.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, when I get to go to these conventions, it's absolutely – it's like being treated like a rock star. You know, they come out, they pay for me, they pay for the food and all this. I'm partying, having fun with people, and it's like, oh, man, this is the life. And then I fly home, and then, oh, God, how am I going to pay the rent? How am I going to pay the bills? Oh, my gosh, I have no I have no session scheduled. And then, you know, back to reality.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think it's really important, the portrait that you're painting, because I think your reality is very common for your field. And most of the time when I interview somebody, they're not willing to paint the picture. You know, it is sort of in Hollywood, I talk a lot about blue collar show business jobs. Yeah. And it seems like that's kind of what it is that you're doing. It's very sort of standard, sort of blue collar freelance work. You gotta hit the pavement, which I don't think most people expect. I think they get Kid A in some minor show, and suddenly they're living in a mansion.
Yeah. You know, and I can sound like a bitter old man and say, "Oh, today's entitled internet generation. Oh, you kids, get off my lawn."
Right.
It's like, oh, I deserve it. Why? Because I want it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you got to work for it, just like everything else. And when you work for it, you appreciate it. When something happens, no matter how little, when you take those baby steps, you feel encouraged, right. whether you have supportive parents or friends or not, or whether you're just doing it 100% on your own, and you're sitting in the middle of Iowa or North Dakota saying, oh, I really want to voice act and I can't do it in, you know, the middle of the cornfields. It's like, well, okay, start saving your money. Go get that dead end minimum wage job and start stashing money away to take classes, to move where the opportunity is. Yeah. It's going to take a long time. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm turning 42 this year, but I'm a voice actor. I'm sure I want to delve into on-camera stuff and try it, but my first passion is behind the mic. Doesn't matter what you look like, what you wear, or whatnot. There isn't that stigma of, oh, you have to look perfect and everything. It's like, well, I don't have to be worrying about any sort of bias there.
Right. It just matters that you can pull the performance off. That's the only thing that counts.
Yeah.
Which is nice. So do you have any dream roles? Anything you wish you could have done or really would like to get coming down the road? I mean, anything like in your head, you're like, wow, beyond even just getting steady work or whatever, if I could do that, it would be like a dream come true.
Yeah. Yeah. I did get to, I got to record on a Star Wars game, but I don't know if it came out yet or not. I did it like 2 years ago. It may be Old Republic. I don't know. But I think being a huge old school Star Wars fan, that was a big notch on the belt to get to do that. But things I every actor would say, hey, you know, what role do you want or you wish you got? And say, oh, well, everything I try out for. I do the best I can with the audition, and then I quickly divorce myself from it and act like it never existed because I'm too busy focusing on the next one.
Right.
Because you'll just drive yourself insane going, oh, I coulda, woulda, shoulda. I hope they call me back. Chances are they're not going to call you back. Not because you suck. You're probably awesome. But guess what? So are the other 200 people that read for it.
Yeah.
And it's a numbers game out here. Luck plays a huge part of it, but it's not all luck. You know, not everyone can be Justin Bieber. Not everyone can be someone that will, you're walking into the grocery store and someone comes up to you, you're going to be a star. That almost never happens. It's so rare that it's not even worth paying attention to. It's like, nope, you got to work for it. You got to take steps.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that before we get to into Twitter, that does remind me. I wanted to talk to you a little bit. You are a definite nerd's nerd.
Sure.
Very much into geek culture.
Yeah.
And I'm just sort of curious, does that help you in your interaction with the fans? Do you feel more like you're one of them and that in turn sort of endears you to them more? Because a lot of voice actors, well, they're actors, you know, they're not necessarily raving about Tron or anything, you know, in their spare time. But you certainly are. And I'm curious how that changes your interaction with real fans.
I think having, you know, something in common is that's the starting point. Obviously, it's one thing for someone to come up and be a fan of a show that I'm in and they know everything about that show or the manga. And I look like deer in the headlights because maybe I haven't seen the show. I've only seen what I recorded. And I'm not connecting on that level because I just haven't lived and breathed the show the way the fan has. But if we start talking about games, technology, movies, and then, you know, that's other passions that mean a lot in my life. I'm a big movie buff. I love games. I love technology. I love my iPhone. You can see people's faces light up when they have nothing in common. Then suddenly, you get the iPad there. Huh? How's that working out for you? And then suddenly you have this great engaging conversation that lasts 15 minutes or longer. And it's really great to connect like that. It's not just a matter of me being nice or trying to escape any awkwardness or anything. It's like, I genuinely want to do this. I like wearing shirts that evoke some sort of response. Like I'm wearing like a Heineken shirt that actually has the Hadouken, you know, Street Fighter word instead of Heineken.
Right.
Or I'll wear a shirt with a, you know, a chicken with a tie. So people go, oh, hentai, haha, you know, right. Conversational shirts, anything to help break the ice. I'm all for that.
All right, so let's go ahead and get to Twitter and a couple of things in from email. Brit Otaku wants to know if you ever narrate your life in the voice from the narrator from DBZ, because she would.
I get a lot of people asking me if, you know, I go through the drive-through at a wherever, a fast food joint, and just order. It's like, I'd like a Big Mac. You know, I haven't done that. Maybe I will one day and then put it on YouTube. Just cuz. But no, I'm actually kind of a shy guy. I'm a shy, quiet dude. I guess that comes from being a Gemini or just being an actor. It's like, okay, I can pretend to be an outgoing, goofy guy, and then I'm just I'm kind of a quiet sponge in some social situations. There's, you know, if you watch panels that I'm on YouTube, sometimes I'm really animated and everything, and other times I'm just like real quiet and give two-word answers. Because I get all paranoid. Every actor is like super neurotic. It's like, I don't want to bore anyone. I don't want to say anything. I want everyone to like me. Oh, like me.
Yeah, incredibly self-conscious about how entertaining you're being at any given moment is like crippling neuroses.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, from JJ Fryer 93 says, some VAs get stereotyped into playing similar characters all the time. What's your opinion on stereotyping, and do you feel you've been stereotyped into a certain type of character?
Sure. I mean, I play a lot of – again, I get called upon mostly as a utility actor. I don't get a lot of big leading roles. But I'm honestly just happy to work. You know, at the end of the day, the paycheck's the same. I mean, if I work 4 hours doing bit parts on something or 4 hours being a lead, you know, the paycheck's the same. I love making money doing something that I love. Whether it's a character that's going to die three lines later or a character that lives after 500 lines. So, you know, stereotyping, sure, every actor wishes they could branch out and try something else. I love seeing the reaction of some of the higher ups at the studio when they go, "That was you? Wow, I never thought." And then suddenly maybe a light will turn on in their head. It's like, yeah, you should read me for other things. Don't always think that I need to play a 40 something. You know, I can have a younger voice. And, you know, I played teenagers. Granted, teenagers with a mortgage, I guess, but yeah. Right. And then older dudes too. I mean, I love voice acting. I was doing bit parts today on something. I wish I had gotten a meatier role. But I think that's any actor's conceit. It's like, I should be the lead. I should get this role. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Me and everyone else.
Right.
But there's only so much.
Is there ever the sense that stereotype me all you want, but give me those roles when you're going to do that?
I could sit here and just complain to myself quietly going, oh, of course they call me to play this guy.
Right.
This guy with this lower bass guttural range. And then I'm going to die five lines later. Yeah, but at least they knew to call me.
Right. <You know? laughs> Yeah, silver lining on that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we don't get these questions, and normally I don't take them, but something tells me maybe you'd be okay playing along. Fist of the MFK and several others suggested that you would be a great voice for Fist of the North Star's Kenshiro. And they really want to hear you do the you're already dead line.
Wow. See, I know the property. I don't know even how that's said. I do know the voice actor for him from the game. But, right. Yeah.
Well,
gosh.
I'm not going to put you on the spot, but but that was floated. So just so you know, people are rooting for you.
Fair enough. I'm an actor. Throw a script in front of me. I could do it. You know, that's fine. I tried out for what it's worth.
Right. Okay, Penguin Truth wants to know if Dragon Ball Kai makes it to the Buu arc, do you think you'll reprise the role of Gohan?
Well, Chris Sabat, who's directing the dub, told me that I will play Gohan again if it goes to that arc. You know, Saiyaman, unfortunately, was a filler arc, and Kai has put it out there that fillers don't exist. So all my characters, mostly Teen Gohan, is mostly a filler character, unfortunately. And so is my other characters, Wes Kai, PyCon, Ox King is in there, but he's hardly in there. So,
right. And with Funimation, and I wanted to mention this, they don't necessarily fly you out there, right? You've got
no, they never. That's on my own dime. All actors, no matter how sort of seniority or whatever, we still have to fly out on our own dime. They tend to book enough hours that will cover the cost of the plane ticket, but, you know.
You're not really profiting.
You're not breaking even until, you know, after the check comes weeks later, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a sticky situation. So probably, have you had to say, like, well, this isn't worth it?
No, not really. I mean, I was at a crossroads, I guess, when Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood came aboard, and Mike McFarlane, the director, said, "Okay, I'll put this on the table. If you want, you're welcome to reprise your role, but because you live in LA, you know, I understand if you don't want to." And I said, "No, I want to. I like being a part of that show, and you know, we'll make it work." And there was compromises sometimes. It's like, well, I only have five lines for you this month. It's like, that's not worth flying out for, because that's not even an hour's worth.
Yeah.
But I did actually record some of my stuff from home. He sent a video file and the Japanese audio, and I would actually kind of mimic. He would actually send a scratch track of him doing the lines, and I would just literally parrot that.
Hmm.
And email it back. They put it into the mix, tweaked it a little bit in Pro Tools, and they said, you wouldn't know the difference.
Well, I've heard a lot about that, where people are now starting to do stuff from there, because audio equipment is cheap. You can set up a little studio in your house for not much. That's what I'm doing this podcast from right now, is all stuff I bought from Guitar Center, so, you know.
Perfect.
Gets cheaper. Okay, Ludono wants to know, what kind of experience did you have voicing Skookumu in Hack GU?
Wow, that was so long ago that I didn't even remember his name. it's a weird disconnect with a lot of games, because what the actor sees is an Excel spreadsheet generated on the screen, or sometimes a paper script, but more and more people are going green. So we're actually just seeing script on screen. Mm-hmm. We'll see everything in columns, time codes, character names, numbers, producer notes, and then the line of dialogue all, you know, laid out. And maybe there'll be a JPEG of a reference of here's what your character looks like. Sometimes, sometimes not. So talk about flying blind. You know, you've got the game producer there and then the actual director, but the director is kind of a conduit for the producer, because the producer is one who lives and breathes, you know, the game and can tell you. It's like, all right, so you're a general. It's like, okay, what about him? What characteristics? Is he a young general? Is he in his 30s? And he's in his 60s? You know, what kind of monster is this? Mm-hmm. Is it a snake? Is it more demon? Is it more this, that, and the other? And then once we get some basics communicated across, then we kind of work on the voice and kind of put it together kind of on the go. I've been called in on games for stuff that I've never even auditioned for. That's a great call to get. You know, it's like, I didn't even try out and suddenly I have work. That's a really nice thing, because you develop a rapport and a professional relationship with these different directors. The directors know what you're capable of based on their past experiences with you. So I get, again, called in to do a lot of utility stuff on games. And say, oh, I know Kyle can, he's efficient, he's quick, he's good, he's got versatile range. Let's call him in. So I will go in completely blind. I will not know what the characters look like. And then we'll build. It's like, all right, this guy, he's an ogre, he's 3 feet tall. And then it's like, well, is it low voice, high voice? Give me what you think, and then we'll tweak it from there.
Well, the dream is to not have to audition at all, right?
That's the perfect thing. Again, always, yeah. You know, getting the call saying, yeah, we booked you for a game or booked you for a show. That's kind of what happened with the Avengers, too. It's like, wow, I get to work on a cartoon. This has only been my dream since childhood, and I don't know what I'm doing until I get there. Literally, the director catches you up to speed, and then off you go.
And they just decided I didn't have to dance for him first.
That's right. Dance, monkey, dance!
Yeah. Okay, so, well, the next question from Ludono is about Final Fantasy XIII. Similar question. Was that the same sort of process where you don't really know what you're doing?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean, what you were saying.
Yeah, I went in completely blind. I actually got a text message saying, you want to be on Final Fantasy 13? And
yes.
That was like the biggest derp moment ever. It's like, yeah. Reply, it's like, yes! And I got called in, and I got, you know, full scale for the game, which I think was close to $800. And I think I worked maybe 10 minutes.
And then, just to make sure that this was a good experience, you didn't actually play that game, right?
That's right. I've never played that game.
Well, it's terrible.
I'm told you have to kill me early on in Cocoon City or something. But, yeah, a couple of random soldiers, and boom, I get to add the credit to my resume. That doesn't suck.
Yeah, that's cool. and finally, from Ludono, he wants to know, why was your pseudonym Squeegee?
Back in the radio days, I remember the boss was like, all right, you got to come up with an air name that people will remember. I said, okay. So I thought back to a time just a few years previous, me and my friends I've known since high school were just sitting there bored, coming up with nicknames that had no relevance. There's no backstory or anything. And one of them was Squeegee. It's like, well, that's a random word. It's like, yeah, those things you wipe the windshield with. Like, why would you name yourself that? It's like, I don't know. It just sounds fun. So when I got on there, I actually carried that name over from working at a heavy metal station. I went from heavy metal to kids radio. How's that for diverse?
Wow.
Yeah, and Squeege. I went by Squeege. And then they thought, wow, that's kind of like Screech from Saved by the Bell. It's like, you remember that name. It's like, yeah, exactly. So I got to keep that when I went to Radio Disney, and
If I ever go back to radio, I'll probably just be me from now on. But
is that tempting at all to go back to radio?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's it. That was my other dream from childhood. I wanted to get on the radio, and I went to radio. I went to college and got a degree in radio, TV, film, and started as at the college station, and then went to an internship at ABC Radio and stayed there for like 13 years. Went from, you know, intern to part time to full time, working on all sorts of different formats. And yeah, I had a blast. And then podcasting started coming into play right around the time I moved to LA. It's like, wow, the face of radio is totally transformed. You don't have to beg a radio station and get an FCC license anymore to give you programming. If you want to do a show about games or anime, you just have to have an internet connection and a mic.
Right. And an audience. That helps.
Well, and an audience, yeah, but you can use Facebook and Twitter. You use social media to kind of whore yourself out and network and piggyback on other podcasts and, you know, word of mouth, scratch my mouth, play my promo, I'll play yours, this, that, and the other. The power of radio put into the hands of anybody, that's kind of reinvigorated me as being a former broadcaster for sure.
Right. Well, if you want to get back into it, you don't have to wait for someone else to tell you that you can. You can just do it now.
That's the beauty of it. That's the total beauty of it. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of podcasts out there that could stand to have a little better production value and some people that could edit out the pauses and dead space and the weird quality and, you know, maybe could use a little more format and consistency. But, you know, God bless them. Passion. It's like, you want to do a show about underwater basket weaving? Do it. Who's going to stop you? Nobody. No one's going to censor you. You don't have to answer to anybody.
Right, which is why there's this huge renaissance in comedians and having podcasts, and why that's so great now is because it's completely in their control. And yeah, it's definitely a renaissance. That's why I started this one.
Well, yeah, and comedians on Twitter. It's like the perfect meld. You got 140 characters to write a great punchline, and people are retweeting it, and suddenly, you know, you have a new digital audience that you didn't before.
All right, from King of Hearts, he wants to know, is it easier to find a rhythm when you're first in the booth to set the rhythm or to come in after other people and bounce off of them?
Well, you don't get to really hear the other performances. It's not like, here, let's watch this scene. The only time we ever do that is it's like to get an idea of what my character is doing in the moment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the characters I'm interacting with haven't been recorded yet. So the only reference is the Japanese. And then, you know, I haven't studied the script or the episode ahead of time. Only the director has. So we're told, you know, the bare minimum. We get the bullet points about what's going on. And then, boom, we're recording it in English or seeing the script 30 seconds before I'm saying it out loud and sounding as if I'm not reading, you know.
Also wants to know, how disappointed were you when you heard that Aniplex wasn't going to be dubbing Gurren Lagann movies?
I don't think my character had that much to do in them, but I was kind of sad for the fan base because it had done so well on Sci-Fi. In fact, it's repeating again. But for whatever reason, they passed on the broadcast rights for the movies, and Aniplex America is like, well, we're not going to dub it unless it goes to TV, which, you know, I understand that viewpoint. You're going to reach a wider audience that way. And Gurren sold a lot of DVDs and the box set that came out last year, too. And that's great. But not enough to keep it going, unfortunately. So that's just kind of the way the industry goes. Some studios have crumbled. You know, some shows come out subtitled only because it is expensive to produce a dub. And I understand from a business point of view why a studio would say, okay, well, if we do this, we have to make our money back. And if we know for a fact that our audience is already fan-subbed and watched this show and aren't going to buy the DVDs, then we're not going to see a return on our investment. Anime is an art form, but it is also a business. And if it's not going to succeed as a business, then it will unfortunately have to morph. And you've seen how digital distribution is changed. The internet has transformed everything, the way we consume our media and the way we broadcast our media. It's just everything has gone to online.
All right. Finally, from Legion, he wants to know, weird wording here, but he wants to know, what was your motivation for recording the voiceover intro for Kevin Smith's Hollywood Babylon podcast?
Well, I've been a fan of Kevin Smith since the first Clerks in the mid-90s, and I love what he's done with his whole podcast network, and Hollywood Babylon is one of my favorite shows. And they were reading an email segment, and someone had submitted some little production sweepers that they could use on some of their stuff, and it's like, you know what? I'll give it a go. You know, I do VO. Maybe I'll submit an intro, and maybe at the very least they'll play it. And they did. And, you know, and it was great. And Kevin Smith laughed and everything. Say, hey, Kyle, you know, I messed up the co-host's name. I said, hey, Kyle, can you re-record that and send it? And they ended up using it. And, you know, I don't get any money for it, but they say anytime you want to come to the show, it's on the house. And that's been great. So I'm hopefully reaching a new audience that way.
Right, so you've been going down to the Smod Castle, as it were.
I did once, and then they kept on consistently selling out, so they actually do their show from Universal Studios City Walk at John Lovett's Comedy Club.
Right.
And yeah, I went on New Year's Eve, and they raped everyone with parking. It was like $40 to park.
Oh, God, Universal.
Yeah, that was pretty evil.
Anytime there's anything Universal.
Got to sit in the VIP section. They gave me a shout out, and it was really nice. It was really cool. And I got to meet Kevin Smith, which I'd never met before. And it was wonderful. Just like, wow, this is surreal.
Okay, man. Well, listen, best of luck to you. And thank you so much for coming on and being so candid and honest. I really appreciate it. It's very enlightening. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Hey, that is our show. I want to thank Kyle for joining me. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. And hey, see y'all next week.